Hello there, Blogging Heads viewers. My name is Betsy Woodruff. I'm a reporter with the Washington Examiner. This show is called Woodruff and Strauss, but Daniel Strauss is not here because we have our very first guest, which is really exciting. My friend Sahil Kapoor, who's a reporter at Talking Points Memo. Sahil, what's your official title?
Senior Congressional Reporter.
Congressional reporter, cool. And today we're going to be focusing on Senate stuff, especially talking about which Senate races are most overhyped. And then looking a little bit at what happens if everyone's prediction comes true and Republicans take the Senate in November. So first off, I think we're interested in talking about the Colorado Senate race, which is one of the more unusual ones. What's kind of your first thought about that, Sahil? What do you think is the most important thing for people to bear in mind with this one?
I mean, I think it's a lot more competitive for Udall than it was supposed to be. No one ever really thought the seat was in play. I think the expectation was that Ken Buck would win the Republican nomination and the Democrats would run away with it by something like 5 or 10 points. But I think with Cory Gardner in the race, he's positioning himself a little more cleverly. And, you know, it's the race has gotten a lot closer than I think a lot of Republicans and Democrats expected. So the last I checked, Gardner's within 3 points of Udall, and you know, you never know what's going to happen in the last 7 or 8 weeks of the campaign. Things are, the fundamentals favor Republicans, so this, you know, I still think Udall has a pretty strong edge. It's going to be difficult to defeat him, but Gardner, the Republican, is doing a lot better than I think many had expected in Colorado.
Did you know much about Gardner before he entered this race? Because I don't follow Colorado politics super closely. But when he entered, that was the first time I ever heard a lot about him. I feel like before he got involved, he didn't have a huge national profile, but maybe I have just been missing prominent Colorado Republican congressmen. What did he have much of a following, or I don't know, established reputation or whatever?
No, I think you're right. He wasn't he didn't have a huge national profile, but he was in a very conservative House district, and he voted very conservative. He was one of the most conservative members of the House. And I think there was also some talk about him supporting personhood measures and stuff like that. And he's made a pretty concerted effort to leap in exactly the opposite direction, I think, starting with his op-ed coming out for over-the-counter birth control, which I think we've seen Tom Tillis in North Carolina do as well. Cory Gardner had voted in 2013, I believe, for the Steve King bill to end DACA, which is the president's deferred action program for young undocumented people. This time around, right before the recess, I think it was August 1st or 2nd, Gardner was one of the few Republicans who voted against it, and that makes sense, sort of, give it, you know, if you want to be a senator from Colorado, where there is a significant Hispanic population, and you can't be super anti-immigrant. So he's positioned himself, you know, smartly, I think, but he's, you know, to the extent that I did know him, and I did cover him, he was always a very conservative guy, predictably conservative.
I think there's an interesting, like, thoughtful think piece to be written about Colorado Republicans sort of having come to Jesus moments on immigration. You know, Mike Kaufman would be sort of the obvious other example. I feel like he used to have just this kind of virulently anti-immigration rhetoric and would say kind of wacky things, and definitely wasn't sort of your Silicon Valley type Republican. And he got redistricted, right? He got redistricted. His district all of a sudden became much more Hispanic, and now he's been studying Spanish and apologizing and sort of doing the "I promise I like Hispanics" apology tour. And it's, I don't know, it's interesting seeing these guys have to very quickly make fairly significant changes in rhetoric and policy just because of how fast American demographics are changing.
I agree. It's kind of the perfect microcosm in Colorado because it's a swing state. And it's really the first swing state where we're seeing a significant and growing Hispanic population that, you know, that candidates there have to contend with. So that's a really good point, I think you raise.
Yeah, and I think Virginia and North Carolina are kind of in the same boat, particularly when you have Virginia even 10 years ago being kind of reliably red, but now it's got two Democratic senators, Democratic governor, voted for Obama in both presidential elections.
Right.
And you know, this former Southern stronghold, and I think in large part because of so much immigration, has become, I mean, I guess it's still a swing state, but it's almost not even a swing state anymore, right? Like, it's almost a reliably blue state.
It's becoming that way so quickly. Yeah, it's true. This was, you know, this is the epicenter of the old Confederacy. And it I think even Bill Clinton lost it at least once, if not twice. Maybe twice, I'm not remembering. But Bill Clinton struggled there. And it voted for Obama twice. And you know, even in a very Republican year, the Democratic Democratic Senator Mark Warner is going to run away with this by, I think, at least 10 points or so. So, yeah, it's shocking how quickly that's happened. Yeah. But I don't know how much that has to do with immigration. I'm really not an expert on the demographics there. But I also think from what I've read, I think it has a lot to do with more liberal populations in the northern parts of Virginia. I think that's grown a lot. At least that's what I've heard.
I've heard people joke about having DC annex Arlington so that so it was a Republican.
Virginia could go red again.
Yeah, pretty much. Although then DC would be so soulless. So I don't know if that's a good idea.
More people without representation.
You know, exactly. A blow for democracy. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Colorado's really interesting. I guess Nevada would almost be in the same boat as far as becoming a swing state and having demographics change really quickly.
But, yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be fun to watch. What do you think of how Democrats have responded to Republicans pushing for birth control being available over the counter? Do you think Democrats have, like, messaged that right? Or do you think it sort of put them on defense?
I don't really know. At first, there was a bit, there was sort of a deer in the headlights quality to the way Democrats responded to Cory Gardner when he came out for over the counter. They're like, whoa, he can't do that. How dare he, you know? And it, sure, that's a position they support. But I think the Democratic position now, and I think it's a smart one, is to get, you know, to get the medical groups, to get the scientists and the OBGYNs out to say, look, this is not enough. You know, there are forms of birth control like the IUD, which are not affordable. Unless you have insurance coverage for it, you can't, you know, over-the-counter birth control, I don't see why Democrats would oppose that. I'm pretty sure they support it, but it's not their point, and I think it's a valid one, is that it's not necessarily enough to get the job done and to, you know, to
get coverage
to the women.
You think Democrats support over-the-counter? You think Democrats support over-the-counter birth control?
To an extent, yeah. I you know, I think there was a... maybe not to the fullest extent that I remember in the Hagen Tillis debate, Hagen talked about how she you know, he brought up over the counter birth control and she agreed that it should be as easily accessible as possible, but there's more to it than that. So I mean, I think there are nuances within that position, because not the pharmaceutical industry, for instance, doesn't want everything to be available over the counter.
Pharmaceutical industry does or doesn't? They would, right?
I think they don't want everything to be available over the counter because I think they make more money off prescriptions.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm trying to think if I can think of any Democrats that have publicly come out for birth control being available over the counter. And I guess besides Hagen maybe intimating that she would support it, I don't know that I can think of them. Because I know one of Tillis's criticisms of Hagen when they were having that conversation in the debate was, I support over-the-counter birth control, and you don't because you're so cushy and buddy-buddy with pharmaceutical companies. So,
right, and then her... I'm not really sure exactly where that came down, and then she said something on the lines of, well, I agree with you that this should happen, but I guess we don't know which part she agreed with and which she didn't, because she's also a politician.
Yeah, just generally, just as a principle.
That's
okay,
an interesting race.
Yeah, it is. If you had to guess... who wins? Who do you think, based on where things are at right now?
Oh, that's a real toss-up. I think that's like the ultimate toss-up of all the toss-ups because Hagen is faring pretty strongly, all things considered. I think she's a little bit ahead in all the polls, but you know, Tillis is also, I think he's a good politician. I think he's dragged down by the fact that he's Speaker of the House in North Carolina, where, you know, which... the legislature is really unpopular there, and noticed in the debate that he kept calling her by her first name, didn't want to mention that she has the office he wants, and she constantly made it a point to call him Speaker Tillis over and over again. That sounds like a good title, but I figured out later that the voters in North Carolina really don't like the legislature, so she wanted to associate him with that. But that's a side point. I really don't know. I really don't know what's going to happen in this race. I think if... I'm starting to think that Hagen is in a better position than the other Democrats in conservative states. To hang on, because North Carolina is sort of a it's definitely a purple state, unlike Arkansas or Louisiana or Alaska. There definitely are progressive strongholds in that state. The real question for her is whether she can get him to turn out like she did in 2008. It's certainly not going to be anywhere near that strong, but she had a pretty significant margin then. I think she if she can get close to close to the way there, if not all the way there with turnout, I think she'll be okay. But you never know.
Yeah,
I think time is
crucial
her
Waukesha
enemy.
County.
Crucial walk.
Interesting.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
What do you think?
Huh. I feel like I would rather be Hagen right now. Partly because of what you said, like North Carolina is definitely more purple than Louisiana or Arkansas or even
Right.
Alaska. I think people forget how competitive it was in 2012 and that it went for Obama in 08. I think the fact that Emily's List has just been full-throated fate in support of Hagen has probably been very helpful to her. I think to the extent that this election becomes about women's issues, if it does,
Yeah.
women's issues in scare quotes, because that's kind of an annoying term. But I think if it becomes about sort of that Democratic talking point, then I think that's also very helpful to Hagen. And yeah, like the North Carolina legislature is obviously going to get a lot of those guys in trouble, and I'm
Right.
not sure that Tillis has an easy job sort of separating himself from that or coming across as a reasonable moderate who can balance out congressional Democrats. And
Yeah.
I think things are better for Hagen now than people might have expected 6 months ago.
You know what?
One thing that's interesting to me, I'm
Go ahead.
sorry.
I said, you know what I
One
would
thing that's
love to
interesting to
see is
me.
a focus group of North Carolina undecided women voters after that debate, because I think he did well overall. I think Tillis was pretty smooth, and he got a lot of punches in. He got his points across, but there was a little bit of a condescending attitude there. I don't know how that came across, and Hagen had this one moment where she just appeared outraged. I can do math. How dare you say I can't? I don't know. I really don't know how that would come across to the undecided North Carolina woman, because I'm not one, but I'd be very interested.
Important caveat. Huh. Yeah, it's interesting, Grace. It's gonna be it's interesting. It's fun. So the next thing is to have a very smooth segue. The next thing that I think we should talk about is which are the most overhyped Senate races this cycle? Ones that are supposed to be really competitive that maybe aren't. What do you think as far as races that are less exciting and less fun than we might have thought they would be a couple months ago?
I'm starting to think Kentucky is one of those.
Yeah.
The polls have been in a dead heat for a really long time, and lately we've seen McConnell eke out a little bit of a lead. I think a few polls have shown him for as opposed to being just completely tied to Grimes. I think might have even I think was even ahead in a couple of them, one or two of them. And now McConnell, I think, has a 4-point lead in the two most recent ones. There are a couple of worrying signs for Grimes, one of which is that I think the CNN poll showed that 16% of Democrats support McConnell. And that shows that,
Seriously? I didn't say that.
and
That seems bad.
16%,
That seems like a problem.
yeah, I think so. It 16% is not a
Huh.
large number, but
But still,
if
yeah.
there is some dissent within the Democratic side of within the Democratic contingent of Kentucky, that's probably not a good sign. I mean, I think it's going to be. I think that's going to be a grind from here till November 4th, and I highly doubt that Grimes can outgrind McConnell on this one. But we'll
Yeah,
see.
and I think people forget how good McConnell is at politics.
Yes,
Just in
even
terms
as
of, I mean, just the fact
unpopular.
that he's one of the smartest people in American politics right now.
Yeah.
Stuff doesn't sneak up on him. He knows what he's doing. He's been doing this forever. His team has been doing this forever. I mean, it's just hard to imagine that he wouldn't be on top of this situation. And
Yeah.
I think if anything, what Grimes' team is really good at is fundraising and communicating. I feel like their PR operation has been really, really strong. Just in terms of going after McConnell on everything. They haven't made a lot of unforced errors. I feel like they've definitely created this image of Allison Grimes, champion of women, person from Kentucky, outside DC. Right. It seems like their messaging has been really good, but looking at recent polls, I don't know that it's necessarily registered.
Yeah, I mean, McConnell's big weakness is that he's really unpopular there. As shrewd and as ruthless a politician, as smart a politician as he is, the people of Kentucky just really don't like him. The best thing he has going for him is that it's a very red state in a year that favors Republicans. And, you know, I think there's some echoes we should take from the 2010 race with Harry Reid, when everyone thought he was going to lose, and he won by like 8 or 10 points. Now, Allison Grimes is not Sharon Engel, no doubt, but
yeah,
I think he's got that state wired in a way that, you know, when you're there for 30 years, I think you got some advantages over someone who's coming in.
Yeah, no kidding. And talking about the Democrats too, it's interesting how many of these coal region Democrats are much less Democratic in their voting habits than they were maybe 10 or 20 years ago. Like particularly looking at West Virginia, parts of Ohio, I think the war on coal rhetoric that Republicans use is probably not helpful nationally. You know, I don't think your average Northern Virginia suburban soccer mom is going to be more likely to go to the polls because she's worried about a war on coal. But I think especially in like West Virginia, which used to be a reliable, just sort of deep royal blue state, you know, now you've got Republicans chipping in very rapidly into Democrats' control. And I think a lot of that is because of some of these EPA regulations that have hit the coal industry pretty hard. So just thinking about like this 16% of Democrats supporting McConnell, that has to be a coal thing, right? I mean, this has to be like Eastern Kentucky coal people who worry about what Washington Democrats are doing, I would think. It's hard to think of another explanation for that.
Yeah, I suspect that's a part of it. You know, I think a big part of the war on coal messaging is just kind of preaching to the choir, but it's also activating and motivating those voters. I also wonder if there's a sort of cultural affinity or a cultural preference that some, I guess, working class white voters in Kentucky have for the Republicans over the Democrats, I think, given the growing gulf between those two parties. But I guess I'm not an expert on that. That's just
my favorite war on coal moment is maybe like a month before the Virginia gubernatorial election. So this would have been like late summer, early fall 2013. There was this really big pro-coal rally in front of the Capitol building. And it was just tons of coal miners and they had their hard hats on and, you know, people from Virginia and West Virginia and Pennsylvania and all over. And all the coal state Republicans were there speaking. You know, you've got Cynthia Lummis from Wyoming and Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia.
Right.
And then Joe Manchin, the West Virginia senator, was also there speaking about fighting back against the president's war on coal and stuff.
Right.
And tons of these coal miners were holding signs that said impeach Obama, like a lot of them, like some company had printed off impeach Obama signs that these guys were holding. And it was just kind of funny to me to see this prominent Democratic senator speaking to a huge crowd of guys waving impeach Obama signs. I just thought it was a little amusing.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of him shooting the cap and trade bill. But again, I think that's just a base strategy. It works in certain areas of the country. Overall, though, I think that issue is kind of a wash nationally, and might even favor the Democrats because, you know, people when you ask people nationally about the president's EPA regulation, do you want strict limits on coal pollution? The answer is overwhelmingly yes. You know, so I think Democrats have an easy counterattack. It just works poorly in certain parts of the country and better in other parts.
Yeah, so I guess Democrats have to take the hit on West Virginia and make up for the loss in other states, which seems pretty doable.
Yeah, they're going to take a huge hit on West Virginia this time, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the state legislature, too. It looks like the state house might go Republican, which would be historic, but that's maybe getting in the weeds a little bit. What do you think about Georgia?
That's another one where I wonder if it's overhyped. I mean, I think the Democrat there, Michelle Nunn, has probably a little bit of somewhat of a better chance than Grimes because she's not running against a longtime incumbent. She's running against a businessman who I guess is a bit of a blank slate because he doesn't have a voting record or a political history that makes him easy to attack, but I've heard a lot and I've read a lot about how the guy is just not likable. And, and Democrats are trying to paint him as sort of a the second coming of Mitt Romney. I don't know how that's going to work in Georgia, which Romney won overwhelmingly, of course. But I think Michelle Nunn is, she's been running a pretty good race. If there was ever a Democrat who could win Georgia in a year like this, it's her. But then again, it is Georgia.
I think a lot of these races, Georgia and also the Texas gubernatorial race, kind of seem like dry runs for 2020, maybe. Where, I mean, obviously none is more competitive than Wendy Davis is, but both of these candidates sort of seem like trial balloons. And depending on how well they can do this year, how well their ground operations are, how much they're able to organize, if they're able to really significantly change turnout, I think that sends a signal to donors about where they should be investing, especially in Texas. Like if Wendy Davis loses by less than 10 points, even less than 8 points, that's a huge indicator that Democrats should just be pouring money into Texas. And I would assume it's kind of the same thing with Georgia, where, if Perdue really beats Nunn by a lot, if it's a definitive victory, then I think Democrats in that state are going to have a harder time getting people to invest in it and getting people to get excited about it. But if it's like 2 or 3 point race, like some polls are showing, then I think 2020 Georgia's maybe Virginia. Is that conceivable? Unless, the Republican Party totally changes and I don't know,
I mean,
the autopsy goes through.
if the Republicans lose Georgia, it's hard to think which states, would still be in their in their camp. I would think
Yeah,
that
right,
if
totally.
Georgia is trending blue, and I think it is, but if Republicans can't adapt to that, then they should probably pack up their bags and go home and shut down the party, I think. They have so many advantages
The
there that
party's over.
but I think you're
Yeah,
totally right
totally.
that in Texas, Dems are playing the long game, and there are real, very significant long-term advantages they have there. I suspect it's not going to happen as soon as they want it to. I think Wendy Davis has a real battle on her hands. I'd be utterly amazed if she wins, but I think you're right. It's a matter of getting close. It's a matter of sending a signal that Texas can, in the foreseeable future, be in play.
Yeah, I agree. Any other races that seem overhyped that are not going to be as competitive as we expect? Like, can we talk about Oregon?
Yes, oh yeah,
Which
that one.
I remember there was like a 2 week period when everyone said Monica Wiebe is maybe going to win in Oregon, and Oregon's on the map. And I feel like after that, we just never heard about Oregon again.
You're right. That is probably the single most overhyped race. And that's not even been that overhyped, but to the extent that it has been overhyped, it's been completely false. I think Merkley's got, he'll probably win by 10 or 15 points, is my guess. She is, she's kind of painting herself. She's kind of portraying herself as the ultimate moderate candidate. She's taken some strides in various different directions. She has, taken a sort of a soft position on abortion. She even had an ad, I think, where she had a gay person in Oregon express support for her. She's tried every, she's trying every trick, but I think Markley is very well liked there, and I think he's also running a pretty strong campaign. So I don't think they have a shot there. But it is the Merkley people. I can tell you this: they definitely did not want to run against Webby. They wanted to run against I think Jay Conger was his name, the more conservative guy.
Jason Conger,
I'm sorry, Jason Conger.
yeah, I think Jason, yeah. Yeah, he was the Rick Santorum endorsee, and yeah, definitely. Cool. Well, I think the next thing is this Stu Rothenberg article saying, and this was really interesting, sort of going from races that are overhyped to questions of hype. For Blogging Heads viewers who don't read roll call every day, which would be inconceivable. I would not read roll call every single morning when they wake up. Who are you guys? Stu Rothenberg wrote this article saying that he think that he you know, he has this sort of algorithm or prediction math thing that he does, this dark arts wizardry of poll analysis that showed Republicans are going to be doing pretty well in the fall. And then he went out on a limb and wrote this column that every single Republican flack emailed to every single reporter in DC saying that that things are probably better for Republicans than they look, and that even though things look good for Republicans right now, that the trend lines are getting better, that Republicans are going to do better than anticipated, and that this is probably going to be a wave election, which is, you know, the fact that he wrote that is very interesting, because it's kind of a risky thing to write. That's a fairly bold prediction, you know, big if true. And I think the NRSC is probably linked to that in every single email they've sent out for the last week, understandably. What do you think, Sile? Do you think that this is shaping up to be a wave election, or do you think Republicans are going to be a little bit disappointed in November?
I really don't know about a wave election. I'm not convinced it will be. I think the Republican advantages are in the fundamentals, mainly in voter turnout and in the simple math of the Senate races. It's following the 2008 Democratic wave, where a bunch of Democrats won in red states that ordinarily wouldn't. And there certainly isn't going to be a Democratic wave this time. But I don't really see, I mean, look, Stu Rothenberg lives and breathes this stuff. He knows it a lot better than I do. From what I've seen, I'm not quite convinced it'll be a Republican wave, because firstly, their brand is really, really weak. And I think it's kind of rare for there to be a wave for a party when their brand is as weak as it is. The president is kind of locked between this 40 to 45% approval rating, which is low, but I think congressional Republicans are somewhere around 10% or so. So, it's going to be, and Congress is lower, Congress as a whole is lower than 10%. So,
jeez.
You know, I just think that's everyone is hated. Everyone is really disliked, but the Democrats' brand is stronger than the Republicans' brand. I think what it'll come down to is the geography of it, the turnout, and I don't know that by itself is going to create a wave. I think it's really race by race, but who knows? I think Stu might be right.
I guess what strikes me about how we talk about elections is that a lot of, you know, polling data that people cite when they talk about whether or not something is going to be a wave or whether or not things are looking good for Republicans or Democrats, a lot of this data seems to be national. The president's national approval ratings, how Congress is doing nationally. Right. And I just have trouble believing that that's relevant, because in this race isn't going to be decided by anyone who lives in New York, anyone who lives in California, anyone who lives in Texas. You look at the most populous states, and you know, not to be uncharitable, but those people's opinions really don't matter when it comes to who controls the Senate. This control of the Senate is going to be decided by a couple thousand people in Alaska, a couple thousand people in Arkansas. If something crazy happens, a couple thousand people in Michigan. And what a bunch of folks in Indiana or Illinois or Florida think about it, I mean, it's not really relevant. I just have trouble buying that national trend lines are going to come into play for Mark Pryor in Arkansas.
Right.
Or even, you know, like you said, for Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, where the Republican brand is bad, Congress's brand is bad, the Senate's brand is bad, you know, hashtag brands. But you can't pull how politically savvy Mitch McConnell is. And you can't pull how politically savvy Mark Pryor is, or how helpful his last name is, or the fact that he's probably shaken hands with every single person in Arkansas by now. And I don't know. I mean, again, you know, Stu Rothenberg is obviously slightly more insightful on this stuff than I am. A little bit. But I don't know. I'm not sure I buy it. The other thing is how ISIS affects this. You know, if the president's approval ratings get a bump from handling ISIS, if we do some shock and awe bombings and he looks presidential and congressional Democrats get to talk about leadership and standing behind the president in wartime, that could be very helpful to Democrats, I would think. Maybe.
I think so. I definitely agree with that. If true, I think the president's just, since his reelection, he's really been locked in this small, narrow zone of 40 to 45%, I think, for the most part.
Yeah.
So it's I don't know how likely it is, but yeah, you're right. I think if his approval rating goes up by 4 or 5 points, suddenly the Democrats are looking, you know, are all the Democrats in the competitive races are in much better shape because they're all running separate from him, but their Republican opponents, every last one of them is trying to tie every last one of the Democrats in the red states to the president because he's especially unpopular there. And you know, they're still doing well in spite of that. So if, you know, these, if a lot of voters associate these senators, these Democratic incumbents with the president and his popularity goes up, of course, it's going to help them on the margins.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
It's interesting how many ads have pictures of the president in it instead of the Democrat who the candidate's running against. I feel like basically every single Republican Senate candidate ad is, here's a picture of the president. Now here's a picture of my Democratic opponent. Vote for me. And like, that's the ad. And it works because his real ratings are so bad. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting 2 months. I guess we'll see. I don't know. I feel kind of like a terrible person talking about, so what does ISIS mean for Arkansas? you know, like how does ISIS fit into America's internal politicking? I mean, like, it's such a horrible group, you know, like literally the most evil people in the world, but it's definitely relevant. I don't know.
Yeah, it's one of those known unknowns, I guess, as Donald Rumsfeld might put it.
That's such a great phrase. Really, really good. So if Republicans take back the Senate and Stu Rothenberg is right and there's a wave and we have Senator Terry Lynn Land and Senator Monica Webby and Senator Scott Brown, what do you think happens in terms of policy? What does that mean for the next, for the last 2 years of the Obama administration?
Right. So those three races you pointed out, I think those are exactly the bellwethers for where they're going to be a wave, right? So if the Republicans win in Iowa, if they're winning in Michigan, or if they're winning in North Carolina, then yes, then we're looking at a wave, I think. But I highly doubt they're going to win any of those three races. Let's say they take the Senate, though. You know, I think they can lose all the three races and still win the Senate. Have 51, 52 senators. This is the question I've been pondering, and I've been trying to figure out what they're going to do. And I, at this point, I'm convinced it's impossible to really know because there are going to be two strong sort of currents pushing them in opposite directions. One is going to be the desire of people like Mitch McConnell and John Boehner, who are, frankly, they're institutionalists. They're not Tea Partiers. They don't want to shut down the government and wage these, you know, these sort of meaningless symbolic fights. They want to actually get something done, and they want to have some sort of a legacy when they're in that position, because they know they won't be there forever. So they're going to want to work with the president on things like trade and get, you know, get things done where they can actually change policy and you know, try to pick out the few areas where the president will give a little. Maybe they'll give a little and get something done. Then there's going to be the opposite current, which is going to be, you know, the Tea Party faction in both the House and the Senate, who are going to say, well, we just won a huge election. This is the conservative mandate to do extremely conservative things. And, you know, that's going to be the Ted Cruz folks. That's going to be, I think, frankly, you know, Marco Rubio and Rand Paul, who are going to be running probably in 2016. They might. I suspect they'll have the better of that debate because that's just sort of where the Republican Party is now. So the real question is which of those two camps wins out.
It could be ugly for Senate Republicans if they take control. You know, I mean, you look at some of the fissures in the conference right now, and you know, tensions, and we know there's really unpleasant, uncharitable backroom conversations and stuff. It's hard to imagine what that would be like if they actually are running things and trying to prioritize what gets voted on and how do you handle Obamacare when Obama's the president.
Right.
So, and yeah, like you said, the fact that like half the Senate's running for president right now would definitely make the governing process really interesting. So yeah, it's weird.
It's really interesting. I mean, this is why
it's a good insight.
People, I think, don't give enough credit to this, or you know, haven't noticed this enough. But the real reason Mitch McConnell was so eager to stamp out, you know, all these Tea Party nominees in places like Mississippi and I think Kansas and really everywhere was not just because he wants to win the Senate. Of course he does, but when he does, he wants to have 51 Republican senators or 50 other Republican senators who will vote with him. You know, so he can actually get things done. He doesn't have to be dealing with the Ted Cruz and Mike Lee faction, or he doesn't want an emboldened Ted Cruz and Mike Lee faction who are just going to oppose him on everything and, you know, prevent him from getting anything done.
It really is remarkable how successful he's been at that, too.
This cycle, absolutely. He failed miserably.
Yeah.
2010 and 2012. He could have won the Senate in either of those, or should have, mm-hmm. I think, geographically. But this time, I think he's certain mm-hmm. not to. And if he doesn't this time, I think 2016 strongly favors the Democrats. So it's now or never, I think.
Definitely. But I guess it's amazing how he's really gone, I guess, 5 for 5 or whatever the number is, as far as defeating Tea Party challengers.
Yeah, it's a wipeout.
I can't think of a Senate race. It's a wipeout, yeah. I can't think of a Senate race besides arguably Nebraska. And Nebraska doesn't really count, where Mitch McConnell's candidate hasn't just obliterated the SCF, Ted Cruz, Tea Party candidate. I mean, even Mississippi, where McDaniel should have walked away with it, pulled it off. And right. And it's also funny to me how the only really big win for Tea Partiers of this cycle is Dave Brat beating Eric Cantor, and the National Tea Party had literally nothing to do with that. And if they had anything to do with it, Eric Cantor probably would have taken the race seriously and would have won.
Right. It's a cool consolation prize, but that's all it is. The Tea Party didn't play there as much as they'd like to suggest otherwise. That was a homegrown rebellion against a guy who didn't go home enough.
Right. They didn't at all. I mean, I think Cantor lost because he made a lot of unforced errors. He didn't go home. He ran these bizarre attack ads against Dave Brat that raised his name ID. His guys tried to do some takeover of the Virginia State Party that failed miserably and that really upset the grassroots people who previously had a live and let live relationship with Cantor. And you take out all that and Eric Cantor is still the majority leader and nobody knows who Dave Brat is. And the Tea Party literally has zero scalps to talk about, right. which is so weird to think about, you know, because this should have been the election that where Tea Partiers would have crushed it. You know, they could have won Mississippi. They theoretically could have won Kansas. And just a batting zero or whatever the appropriate sports metaphor there is. It's kind of weird, you know?
Yeah,
that's true. Any other thoughts on like specific things you would expect from a Republican Senate? What would you think is the first thing McConnell does if they take it back?
The first thing he does is grind every nomination to a halt. I think people also don't give enough credit to this. The by far the most important thing that's actually at stake in terms of, you know, what it means for the country and what it will mean for the long term is nominations. When Harry Reid became Senate Majority Leader in 2007, he basically grinded President Bush's nominations to a halt. And I think Mitch McConnell is going to do the same thing. McConnell's been much more aggressive with the filibuster, you know, throughout President Obama's tenure than Harry Reid was with Bush when he was Minority Leader. So McConnell's going to, I think, put a stop to filling pretty much any seat in the circuit courts. I think he's going to block a lot of trial court judges on the federal level, obviously. And who knows what happens if there's a Supreme Court vacancy. I think that's going to be a pretty epic battle if McConnell's a majority leader. I cannot possibly envision a scenario where it's 2015 or 2016 and Senate Majority Leader lets Obama confirm any Supreme Court nominee. I just cannot imagine that happening. So I think that
what happens if a Supreme Court justice retires or, you know, God forbid, passes away, and there's a vacancy in January 2016, and Mitch McConnell's the Majority Leader? Does it just stay vacant?
I think it stays vacant. I think he runs out the clock until in his mind, hopefully, a Republican wins the White House and they get a bite of that apple. Think about the Supreme Court, how closely divided it is, and how that 5-4 majority, how many issues, how much of the law and how much of the country that shapes. You change one vote there, even if it's replacing another one liberal justice with another liberal justice, that I think solidifies some of the 5-4 victories that progressives have for another generation. Stakes mm-hmm. are just so high that and McConnell recognizes this. He's a long game kind of guy with policy.
Any besides nominations, is there a legislative priority you would expect Republicans to work on, or another particular issue that you think they'd jump at if they took over?
Probably trade, because that's one area where they agree with the president and the congressional Democrats don't. It's hard to know. I mean, I know there's some clamor in Republican committees to change things about Medicare and Medicaid, maybe Social Security, although that's unlikely. I really don't know what's going to happen, but I think it's just impossible to know. You'd have to. It would depend on how many seats Republicans have, what the political dynamics there are, who's running for president, and what sorts of things McConnell feels like he can and cannot do politically. Really hard.
It's going to be interesting to see. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see, assuming that he wins, to see how Ben Sasse fits in the conference too, because he kind of has a foot in both worlds in terms of conservatives and the establishment, you know, institutional Republican leaders. Be interesting to see if he sort of fashions himself as a go-between, you know, someone who can be all things to all men, or if he becomes a McConnell lieutenant or what have you. So, well, this was really good. Any final thoughts, things you're keeping on your radar for the next couple weeks, or?
Just everything we talked about. See how it all progresses.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Sahil. It was really good talking, as always.
Thanks, Betsy. Of course.
All right.